beyond their natural frontier, and who maintained that it would have been both practical and philosophically wrong. He also said that their systems of ethics which regard treachery and violence as virtues rather than vices has produced a code of honour so strange and inconsistent that it is incomprehensible to a logical mind. Anybody who enters a war of the sort we have entered to in Afghanistan, who ignored that sort of advice given all those years ago, it was an unwise decision.
OK, Mervyn Warner, thank you. Ian Massingham now from Norfolk.
Hello, Jonathan, thanks. I'd rather a lot of stuff to say, but I know you're trying to squeeze things in.
I'm afraid so.
I'm ringing from the point of view that I've actually been to Afghanistan. I went four times in the early 70s. And I wanted to talk about the fact that the Afghanis are Afghanis because they come from a certain country, but we drew lines between the tribal regions and all the people that live in northwest Pakistan and in, or northwest Pakistan and north Afghanistan are all there as a tribe, not as different tribes, as different countrymen. I talked to an old man when I was in Peshawar who related to me wars that had been handed down to him, and especially from the late 1800s, where he described the British Army used to march around in red tunics with short-range rifles.
And I'm afraid this is genuinely really interesting. What's your instant thought in a sentence? Have we learned from history? Haven't we learned from history?
Right, I think we can't win. It'll become America's Vietnam. We won't come out completely, and I think we ought to stop the war.
Ian Massingham, on that very explicit and clear note, thank you very much. Thanks for all your calls, emails. Next week, Charles Kennedy, Chukwuma Muna, Shadow Secretary for Business, Innovation and Skills, and Rita Clifton, the Chairman of Interbrand. Join us next week. Thanks for your calls. As I say, good afternoon.
Any Answers was presented by Jonathan Dimbleby and produced by Rachel Simpson. Now, on BBC Radio 4, we continue our classic Chandler series. Toby Stevens plays the iconic private eye, Philip Marlowe, and he's about to step inside a household like no other in Raymond Chandler's The High Window, dramatised by Robin Brooks.
The house is on Dresden Avenue, in the Oak Knoll section of Pasadena. A big, solid, cool-looking house with burgundy brick walls and terracotta tile roof. All I know about the people is that they are a Mrs. Elizabeth Bright Murdoch and family, and that she wants to hire a nice, clean private detective who won't drop cigar ash on the floor and never carries more than one gun. And I know she's the widow of an old coot named Jasper Murdoch, who made a lot of money helping out the community and got his photograph in the paper every year with the legend, "His life was his service."
Yes?
Philip Marlowe, calling on Mrs. Murdoch by appointment.
Which one?
Huh?
Which Mrs. Murdoch?
I didn't know there was more than one.
Well, there is. You got a card?
Here.
Brother. This way.
He leads me to a small room furnished as an office. A thin, fragile-looking blondish girl in shell glasses is sitting behind a desk.
I'm Miss Davis, Mrs. Murdoch's secretary. Do you have your references?
Sure. Here. This is from Bernie Oles of the DA staff, and this is from Detective Lieutenant Carl Randall of the Central Homicide Bureau. You think that'll be enough?
Please don't laugh at me. I'm only doing what I'm told.
I'm not laughing at you. Hot, isn't it?
It's not hot for Pasadena. If you'll just wait a few minutes.
Halfway to the door, she turns back and pushes the top drawer of her desk shut. Then she goes out. I stick a cigarette in my mouth, but don't light it. I go around the desk. I'm just curious. It isn't any of my business that she has a small Colt automatic in the drawer.
Mrs. Murdoch will see you now.
The room is a sort of sun porch that has been allowed to get completely overgrown outside. There's a chaise longue over by the window. It has a curved back and enough cushions to stuff an elephant. And there's a woman leaning back on it with a wine glass in her hand.
Please do not light that cigarette. I'm asthmatic. Sit down, Mr. Marlowe. I've never had any dealings with private detectives, Mr. Marlowe. I don't know anything about them. Your references seem satisfactory. What are your charges?
$25 a day. And, of course, expenses.
It seems high. And how much retainer would you expect?
$100 would hold me.
I should hope it would. My asthma. I drink this wine as a medicine. That's why I'm not offering you any. Here's the situation. About a year ago, my son made an idiotic marriage without my consent. This was foolish of him, as he has no money except what I give him, and I am not generous with money. The lady was a nightclub singer called, appropriately enough, Linda Conquest. They lived here. We didn't quarrel, because I don't allow people to quarrel with me in my own house. But there has not been good feeling between us. No doubt she found my son dull. I find him dull myself. At any rate, she moved out a week or so ago without saying goodbye. She took with her a rare gold coin, the pride of my late husband's collection, called a Brasher Doubloon. It is said to be worth over $10,000. It's a mint specimen.
Pretty hard to sell.
Perhaps. I didn't miss the coin till yesterday, when a man named Morningstar called up. Said he was a dealer and was the Murdoch Brasher, as he called it, for sale. My son took the call and reported the conversation to me. I had Miss Davis call him back. I was curious.
Why?
If the man was a dealer of any repute, he would know that the coin was not for sale. My husband provided in his will that no part of his collection might be sold. He seemed to feel that I ought to have taken more interest in his little pieces of metal when he was alive. I spoke to Mr. Morningstar. He has offices in downtown Los Angeles. I told him the coin was not for sale. He asked if he might examine it. I said, certainly not. He hung up. So I went upstairs to examine the coin myself. It was gone.
Somebody offered him the coin for sale, and he guessed where it had come from.
I had the same idea.
How do you establish that your daughter-in-law took it?
I don't, in a strictly evidential sense. But I'm quite sure of it.
No signs of a burglar? Maybe I'd better look the room over.
I have told you, Mr. Marlowe, that my daughter-in-law took the Brasher Doubloon.
Assuming that is so, just what do you want done?
I want it back, and I want an uncontested divorce for my son.
Does he know where she went?
Oh, he knows nothing. He doesn't even know of the theft. I don't want him to know anything. This is a delicate family matter, Mr. Marlowe. And it must be handled with delicacy.
If you hire me, you'll get all the delicacy I have. If I don't have enough delicacy, maybe you'd better not hire me.
Miss Davis, my checkbook right away.
Yes, Mrs. Murdoch.
Make out a check for $250 and keep your mouth shut about it.
You know, I never talk about your affairs, Mrs. Murdoch.
Yes.
I wouldn't dream of it.
Yes, yes, go along.
I need a photo of your daughter-in-law.
On the table. You can take it.
Anything you can tell me about Linda?
Before she married my son, she shared an apartment with a girl named Lois Magic. Charming names these people choose for themselves. They worked at a place called the Idle Valley Club. My son knows it far too well.
It's possible your son is still in touch with his wife.
I don't think so.
He must know something about her.
You leave my son out of this.
Okay. She take a car?
Steel gray Mercury, a coupe. Miss Davis can give you the license number.
If I find she didn't steal the coin, that ends the investigation.
She stole it, all right, and I don't intend to let her get away with it. Paste that in your hat, young man. And I hope you're even half as rough as you act, because these nightclub girls are apt to have some very nasty friends.
I'll try the coin dealer first. He sounds like a lead.
You don't like me very well, do you?
Does anybody? Cheer up, Miss Davis. You ought to feel sorry for her. She thinks she's tough and she's breaking her back trying to live up to it.
Don't touch me, please.
Sorry.
I only want to do my best for her. Is there something you want?
I want to know about Miss Lois Magic.
Oh, she used to share an apartment with Linda. She only came here once. She came with a Mr. Vanier.
Who's he?
She just came with him. I don't know him.
What does Miss Lois Magic look like?
Very, very appealing.
You mean sexy?
Well, in a nice, well-bred sort of way, if you know what I mean.
I know what you mean, but I never got anywhere with it.
I can believe that.
Know where Miss Magic lives?
No.
That looks like a man's handkerchief. Did you swipe that?
Oh, don't carry the tough guy manner too far, Mr. Marlowe.
I'm not tough, just virile.
Perhaps I don't like virile men.
You're a screwball if ever I met one. Goodbye, Miss Davis.
I walked through the big empty house and out into the warm air.
Brother, it's even worse than I expected.
A small sand-colored car is sitting on the curb behind me. There's a man in it wearing a cocoa-colored straw hat. I don't think anything of it. I go back to my office, light a cigarette, hoist the phone book onto the desk, and find Elisha Morningstar.
Morningstar?
You called Mrs. Murdoch in Pasadena about a certain coin.
Who is this?
Philip Marlowe, a private detective. My understanding is you wish to buy the coin in question.
The coin is not for sale.
I still want to talk about it, in person.
Indeed.
The point is, you already knew the coin wasn't for sale when you called.
Interesting. How?
You're in the business. You couldn't help knowing.
I shall be glad to see you. In my office, at 3:00. Will that suit?
I'll be there. Okay. Yeah.
Your Marlowe?
Uh-huh.
I'm a little disappointed. I expected someone with dirty fingernails.
Come inside and you can be witty sitting down.
A private detective. I never met one. Shifty business, one gathers. Keyhole peeping.
You here on business or just slumming?
The name is Murdoch. I gather you are hired to find my wife.
You made nice time over here.
A little worm told me. A simple garden worm, often trodden on, but surviving, like myself.
Uh-huh.
I don't think I'm going to like you.
Ooh.
Your tough guy act stinks.
Coming from you, that's bitter.
Why should my mother want Linda found? She hates to spend money.
Who said she did?
Merle Davis.
Miss Davis is just a romantic. She probably made it up. Hell, she blows her nose with a man's handkerchief, probably yours.
Look, Marlowe, be reasonable. Give me an idea of what it's all about. I haven't much money, I'm afraid, but would a couple of hundred do?
I ought to bop you. Besides, I'm not supposed to talk to you. Orders.
Maybe it's not Linda you're after. Maybe it's someone else.
Maybe.
Maybe it's Nash.
Nash?
Runs the Idle Valley nightclub?
Uh-huh. Maybe it's him.
I'm in a spot here. Nash must have called her up. He promised not to.
How much are you into him for?
Maybe it isn't Nash.
Maybe it isn't. Maybe the cook's with Child by the Iceman. But if it was Nash, how much?
$12,000.
Threats? Is he tough?
I suppose. He used to be a screen heavy. Good looking in a flashy way, but don't get any ideas. Linda just worked the nightclub. And if you are looking for her, you'll have a hard time finding her.
Why? She's not buried in the backyard, I hope.
It's a waste of time talking to you.
I don't think you're worried about your wife. I think you know where she is. She didn't run away from you. She ran away from your mother. Perhaps you'll get a job and make enough money to support you.
He looks down at the floor, turns his body to the right, and his fist makes a tight, unrelaxed arc through the air towards my jaw. I move my jaw out of the way and catch his wrist.
How come your old man didn't leave you any money? Or did you blow it all?
Jasper Murdoch wasn't my father. My father was a man named Horace Bright who lost his money in the crash and jumped out of his office window.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry I made the crack. I just wanted to get your goat.
Well, you got it.
So I know that Alex Nash runs the Idle Valley nightclub, and it doesn't take me very long to find out that he has recently married a gaudy young blonde named Lois Magic and is now living in Bel Air. No one answers the front door, so I try the back. A long-limbed showgirl is lying on a chair beside the pool. From 30 feet away, she looks like a lot of class. From 10 feet away, she looks like something made up to be seen from 30 feet away. Standing over her is a man with a clear olive skin and gleaming white teeth, white shirt, and white slacks.
Hey, you! What do you want?
Want to see Mrs. Nash.
She's not at home. Beat it.
Oh, sit down and rest your sex appeal. So, who are you, big boy?
I'm looking for a friend of yours. Linda Conquest.
Lois?
Oh, shut up. Well, I don't think I've seen her in 6 months. What do you want to know for?
Just a private inquiry.
About what?
A confidential matter.
Just think. He's making a private inquiry about a confidential matter. Who told you I knew her?
I never reveal a source of information, Mrs. Nash.
Oh, sweetheart, you're fussy enough to be a dance director. I should tell you everything. You should tell me nothing. Who's looking for her?
Her folks.
She doesn't have any.
You must know her pretty well, if you know that.
You're not wanted here. The sooner you get out, the better we like it.
Are you Mr. Nash?
Get out, mug.
This is Mr. Vanier. Don't get so hostile, darling. You're not built for the rough work. That right, big boy?
I think you could tell me where Linda is, if you wanted to.
How are you going to make me want to?
With all these people around, how can I?
That's a thought.
Get out while you can still walk!
Where's your refinement?
I'd plug you as soon as I'd strike a match.
Don't tell me you wear a gun under that fancy shirt.
I look at the blonde. Her eyes are bright and her mouth looks sensual and eager. I turn and walk away. Once I'm through the gate, I lean round and look back. Vanier is practically sprawled on top of her, kissing her. I shake my head and go back to my car. A sand-colored coupe pulls out behind me, driven by a man wearing a cocoa-colored straw hat. I take the car to 7th and Olive and walk over to the Hotel Metropole and wait for the straw hat to come in.
Light. Oh, thanks. Haven't I seen you somewhere before?
Over on Dresden Avenue in Bel Air.
I must be lousy.
The hat doesn't help. You stay too close.
Phillips is the name. We're in the same racket. I'm a private investigator.
Do you want something, or are you just practicing?
I know who you are. I was a deputy at Ventura when you were working on the Gregson case. Really, I was just trying to screw up the courage to talk. When I saw the guy going to your office, I figured maybe we could make a deal, pool our resources.
Guy? You mean Leslie Murdoch?
I'm working for his wife.
Divorce?
So she says.
They both want one. Comical, isn't it?
On my end, I don't like so well. It's a guy tailing me around. A very tall guy with a funny eye. Tall, like a lamppost. Anything to do with you?
Not that I know of. I'd like to talk this thing over properly, but I have an appointment.
Well, you could come on to my apartment. What time would you think?
About 4:30.
Here. 204 Florence Apartments, Court Street.
Bunker Hill?
I haven't been in the chips lately. Do you mind?
No. This divorce stuff is a lot of hooey. Something else, isn't it?
Yeah. See you at 4:30.
Mm-hmm.
Elisha Morningstar's office is in the Belfont building on the 8th floor. The old man working the elevator looks as if he's been sitting there since the Civil War and came out of that badly.
8th floor.
Thanks.
The office is at the back. Elisha Morningstar, numismatist. I have to go through a little empty reception room to get to it.
Come in. You are Mr. Marlowe?
Yeah.
Pray be seated. Well, Mr. Marlowe, what can I do for you?
Tell me about the Brasher Doubloon.
Ah, yes. The Brasher Doubloon. In some ways, the most interesting and valuable of all early American coins. It was a gold coin made for the state of New York in the year 1787. It was not minted. It was coined by the pressure molding process, and its maker was a private goldsmith named Ephraim Brasher.
How many of these coins are there?
A few hundred. But of these, very few indeed are uncirculated specimens in what is called mint condition. Handled by a reputable dealer, such a specimen might easily bring $10,000. We'd have to have a history, of course.
And without a history?
There would be the implication that the coin was illegally acquired.
So, let's talk about the Brasher Doubloon that somebody tried to sell you.
Did they? Why would they do that?
They needed the money. You'd want to buy it if you could get it cheap and had the money to handle it. But you would want to know where it came from. And if you were quite sure it was stolen, you could still buy it if you could get it cheap enough. You'd be protecting the owner or his insurer. They'd be glad to pay you back your outlay. It's done all the time.
Then the Murdoch Brasher has been stolen.
Don't quote me. It's a secret.
And how much will your principal pay for the return of the coin?
$1,000. What did you pay?
$800.
Fine. That leaves $200. Got it with you?
It's not in my office. Do you take me for a fool? Come back with your money tomorrow morning. Shall we say 11?
Uh-huh.
Oh, and no tricks, Mr. Marlowe. Don't think I don't know how to protect myself.
I hope you do, because what you're handling is dynamite.
I tramp across the empty outer room, open the door and let it shut, staying inside. A kid's trick, but it usually works. I sneak back across the threadbare carpet, put my ear to the door.
The Florence Apartments? Yeah, I'd like to speak to Mr. Phillips in 204. I see. No message. I'll call later.
I do a rapid glide to the outer door and go through it very silently, like snow falling. While I wait for the elevator, I look at the card that Phillips gave me. 204 Florence Apartments. Bunker Hill is old town, lost town, shabby town, crook town. Out of the apartment houses come women who should be young but have faces like stale beer. Men with pulled-down hats and quick eyes that look the street over behind the cupped hand that shields the match flame. Worn intellectuals with cigarette cops and no money in the bank. Fly cops with granite faces and unwavering eyes. Cokies and coke peddlers. People who look like nothing in particular and know it. And once in a while, even men that actually go to work. But they come out early, when the wide, cracked sidewalks are empty and still have dew on them. I park at the end of the street and walk along. Across the street is an Italian funeral home. The entrance door to the Florence Apartments has a glass panel and enough of the name left to be read. I go up the stairs. Across the hall from 204, someone's having a party. There's no one in the hall. I knock. I try the door. It's unlocked. I go in. A square room with a brown carpet, very little furniture, and that not inviting. A wall bed. There's a door beside the bed. Must lead to the bathroom. I push it. My nose twitches and my lips stiffen as I smell the harsh, sharp, bitter smell. The floor of the bathroom is too short for Phillips, so his knees are poked up and hung outwards, slackly, and his head is jammed tight against the wooden baseboard. His open mouth is full of shiny crimson blood.
Nothing in this, Marlowe. Nothing at all. Nothing for you here. Get out. Get out fast.
I go back down and stand in the half dark of the lobby, looking at the little sign that says Manager's Apartment. I'm a fool to even look at it. I knock.
Phillips.
Yeah?
204, he's not in.
What should I do, lay an egg?
Neat, you have him all the time, or is this your birthday?
Beat it, Drift.
$5. The name's Pollock, Reliance Indemnity, field agent.
Phillips is no good.
Jewelry.
He didn't look like it to me. Soft looking. He's only been here a month.
What say we frisk the apartment while he's out?
Oh, Mr. Palermo wouldn't like it.
Mr. Palermo?
Yeah, he's the owner. Has the funeral parlor across the street. Uh-huh. Practically owns the district, if you know what I mean.
Well, while he's playing with a stiff, let's go up and frisk the apartment.
Don't get me sore at you.
That'd bother me like 2% or nothing at all. Let's go up and frisk the apartment.
You said something about 5.
I thought better of it. Let's go up and frisk the apartment.
You say that just once more.
If you're thinking of pulling a gun, Mr. Palermo wouldn't like it.
Yeah, to hell with him.
Mr. Palermo will be glad to know how you feel about him.
Look, I was just sitting having a beer. I wasn't bothering anybody. It was a nice day.
Let's go up and frisk the apartment.
Why, you? If it wasn't for this job...
Let's go up and frisk the
apartment. Don't say it. Just, let me get the keys.
Oh, come on, I can't hear it. Oh, come on, I'm
trying to let the Sounds like they're having a party across the way.
Hey, keep it down in there.
Yeah?
Yeah, pipe down, too much racket. I don't aim to ask you again.
Hey, Dal, the guy says to pipe down. You want to suck him?
Eh? You'll buzz off. You heard me, Mr. Hinch. Too much noise.
Listen, pickle puss.
Hinch leans forward with his right foot in a hard stamp. The manager doesn't wait to be stamped on. His hand makes a sweeping movement and comes up with a blackjack.
Yeah?
Hinch swings hard at nothing. The manager hits him on top of the head. Hinch turns, runs back to the bed, feels under the pillow.
Look out. Gun.
Yeah, I can fade that too.
Hinch comes up with a gun. He's staring down at it. Not holding it by the grip at all, holding it in the flat of his palm.
Drop it.
Get him down.
The blonde jumps on the manager's back and wraps her arms around him.
Get him good.
This ain't my gun. This ain't mine.
Thank you.
I step around the manager and relieve him of the gun he's trying to pull.
Hey.
Okay, drop it, Hedge.
This ain't my gun. Mine's a Colt 32 belly gun.
I take the gun off him.
It's been fired. Hey, better get some law. This gun's been fired, and there's a dead man across the hall.
What?
Brother, that simply ain't my gun.
Shot in the throat with a medium caliber gun, a soft-nosed bullet. Gun like this one.
Detective Lieutenant Jesse Breeze is balancing the gun on his hand. The gun Hinch says isn't his.
Dead about 2 hours.
He's a big man. Rather paunchy, with a calm, unwinking, unwavering stare in his pale blue eyes.
It ain't my gun. And nothing you boys can think of is going to make me say this.
We're sitting in Hinch's apartment. The girl is lying on the bed, white and silent now.
So someone swiped your gun and left this one?
Mm-hmm.
How come?
Look, we went out. We went out to get some lunch by 3:30. We must have left the door unlocked. You remember, honey? Honey, you remember?
She doesn't look at him.
Mine's a revolver. It's not an automatic. I don't have no permit. I don't carry it around, so...
Hitting the hooch like you birds been and having a gun under the pillow, sooner or later somebody was going to get shot.
We didn't even know a guy. We don't know anything about him.
I guess he got shot just before you went out. The radio would kill the noise. Maybe you left your door open.
Maybe. Yeah, you remember that, honey?
You left your door open. The killer heard you go out. He got into your apartment wanting to ditch the gun. Slipped it under your pillow and then, imagine his surprise, found another gun. So he took it along. But if he meant to ditch his gun, why not do it where he did the killing? Why the fancy pants?
Maybe he only thought of ditching it when he got out in the hall. Didn't want to go back in there. Saw the door open here.
I'm not saying it isn't so. I'm just considering. So, mister, now we've got to try and trace your gun. While we do that, we've got to have you and the young lady handy. Understand?
You don't have any boys that can bounce me hard enough to make me tell that any different.
We can always try. And we might just as well get started. Spangler! You all right, sister?
It's Shock.
Wake up, honey.
Hey, leave her alone. It's Shock.
Lieutenant Spangler will take you down, all right?
You know what, babe? We gotta take a ride.
The blonde gets up slowly.
It's tough, Kim, but you know how it is.
She looks at him blankly, then draws back her hand. Inch follows her out. The door closes. Bree's and I sit looking at each other, heavily.
You and me are going to get along.
That's fine.
You don't think so, but we are. Not because I took a sudden fancy to you. It's the way I work. Everything in the clear, everything sensible, everything quiet. Tell what you know about the dead guy.
I already told you.
Tell me again.
His name is George Anson Phillips. He claims to be a private detective. He followed me around today. He said it was because he wanted to do business with me. He said he was on a job, he got leery of, and wanted someone with a little more experience than he had, if he had any at all. He didn't act as if he had.
And the only reason he picked you is that 6 years ago you worked on a case in Ventura while he was a deputy there?
That's my story.
It's bad enough to be true. So, what's your idea of all this?
My idea is you will find out he was hard because he was simple, and to do something that turned out to be not what he liked, he got scared.
And as a result of this, he asked you to meet him in his apartment?
Yeah.
Why couldn't you talk to him right then?
I had an appointment.
Who with? What you working on? Marlowe, this is murder. You're gonna have to tell me.
Nope.
Look, you got to.
I'm sorry.
I could throw you in the can as a material witness.
Are you going to?
You got any friends?
Nope.
No one in the department?
Nope.
How about a homicide?
There's Randall, but he doesn't like me too well.
Is this on the level, or are you just being smart? I mean, about all the important guys that you don't know.
It's on the level, but the way I'm using it is smart.
It ain't smart to say so right out.
I think it is.
Why don't you go on home and let a man work?
All right.
We'll want a statement. Maybe tonight.
I'll be home tonight.
I take in my office on the way home. There's a boy in a uniform cap behind me on the stairs.
Marlo?
Uh-huh.
Delivery.
Here.
Gee, thanks, mister.
I cut the string from around the package and unwind the thin brown paper. Inside is a cheap cardboard box. I pull off the lid. I'm looking at a large gold coin, bright and shining, as if it had just come from the mint. The side facing me shows an eagle with a shield for a breast and the initials EB punched into the left wing. I'm looking at the Brasher doubloon.
Yeah. Yeah?
Too bad for you, Marlowe.
I hang up. I hide the coin in my tobacco pouch and go down to the phone booth in the drugstore and phone Mrs. Elizabeth Bright Murdoch.
Yes?
Mrs. Murdoch, could you identify the property we were talking about this morning? Could you pick it out from others just like it?
I don't really know. It's not important now.
Not important?
Have you anything else to report?
Do you know a man named George Anson Phillips?
I do not. Why should I? This is all very unnecessary now, Mr. Marlowe. I have decided to drop the matter.
Why?
The coin has been returned to me.
What?
The circumstances are a little difficult. I may decide to explain, or I may not.
Mrs. Murdoch...
You may call me at the house tomorrow morning. You may keep the retainer as payment in full.
You actually got the coin back? Not a promise of it?
Certainly not. And I'm tired. So if
One moment, Mrs. Murdoch. It isn't going to be as simple as that. Things have happened.
In the morning, you may tell me about them.
I go to a hog shop on Santa Monica.
A quiet, old-fashioned little place.
Gold, is it? A gold hoarder you are, maybe.
$25. The wife and kiddies are hungry.
Oy, that's terrible. Oh, gold it feels, by the weight. Only gold, and maybe platinum it could be. Gold it is. $10.
$25.
For $25, what would I do with it? Sell it, maybe. For $15 worth of gold is maybe in it. Okay, $15.
You got a good safe?
Mister, in this business are the best safes money can buy. Nothing to worry about here. It's $15, is it?
Make out the ticket.
Name? Address?
Marlowe. Bristol Apartments, 1634 North Bristol Avenue.
Oh, you're living in that district and you're borrowing $15?
I put the pawn ticket in an envelope and mail it to myself. Then I drive downtown to the Bellefonte building. There are a few lights still on. The only soul to be seen is the same old plow horse sitting in the elevator.
I don't suppose you know where I can get in touch with the building superintendent.
He's home, ain't he?
Probably. But where is home? What's his name?
You want something?
Yeah, I want the address of one of the tenants, where he lives when he's not in his office.
Which one?
Mr. Morningstar.
He ain't at home.
How do you know?
'Cause he's still in his office.
Are you sure?
Sure, I'm sure. Going up.
Mr. Morningstar?
Morningstar lies crumpled on his back. Very lonely. Very dead. The safe door is wide open. It's empty. I wipe the doorknobs and walk down the fire stairs to the sixth floor. I read the names on the doors going along for no reason at all. H.R. Teeger, Dental Laboratories, L. Pridview, Public Accountant, Dalton and Reese, Typewriting Service. The elevator comes growling up and the old man doesn't look at me. His face is as empty as my brain.
Going down?
Going down.
The chessmen are lined up and ready to go. It's 10 o'clock in the evening. I'm at my apartment with a drink at my elbow and nothing on my mind except two murders. And the mystery of how Mrs. Elizabeth Bright Murdoch has got her brasher doubloon back while I still had it in my pocket.
Who is it?
Reed. I live here.
Mind if I look around?
Fooey on you.
Play a lot of chess?
Not a lot. I was just setting the pieces out before you called. Once in a while, I fool around with a game, thinking things out.
Don't it take two guys to play chess?
I play over tournament games. Like in that book. Games by a guy called Capablanca, a grandmaster. Once in a while, I think out problems. What are we talking about chess for?
I talked to Randall about you. He says you wouldn't murder anybody.
That was friendly of him.
He says we should look out for you. He says you're not as smart as you think you are, but that you're a guy things happen to, and a guy like that could be a lot more trouble than a very smart guy. That's what he says. You look all right to me.
That's nice of you.
You found Phillips's body. You talked to the guy. You said you didn't know what he wanted to see you about. I figure that maybe with time to think back, you could have remembered. This your gun?
Uh-huh.
A little dust.
What were you expecting, rubies? I look at Breeze. He looks about as excited as a hole in the wall. He's lighting his cigar in the exact same way as when he lit it in Hench's apartment. Every motion the same as it always will be whenever he lights a cigar. He's that kind of man, and that's what makes him dangerous.
You're on a job. We don't know what it is. Phillips was playing at being a private dick. He was on a job. How can we know that his job and your job don't tie in somewhere? And if they do, that is our business.
That's one way to look at it.
This is a murder case, Marlowe.
I have a right to listen to my conscience.
I have a right to protect my client until I'm sure you won't do him more harm than you'll do the truth good. Or until I'm hauled before somebody who can make me talk.
You sound to me just a little like a guy who's trying to hold his conscience down.
What did you find out about Phillips?
He came into a little money. Not much, but enough to get a license and put up a bond and get himself a piece of an office. He shared a room with a guy named Marsh. Says he never had any customers. That's all we know about George so far. Kind of a pathetic case.
What about Hinch?
Him and the girl were having a liquor party. I guess it'd been going on for days.
What about the gun? You believe someone planted it under Hinch's pillow?
Sure. The killer went in and ditched his gun and found another.
What about Hinch's gun?
I doubt we'll ever find it. It's a dead end. I don't know what to make of you. I can't see you deliberately covering up on a murder, and neither can I see you knowing as little about all this as you pretend. How long do you expect to stay dummied up?
I don't know.
Let me help you. I'll give you till tomorrow noon. I won't get my postmortem report before that anyway. Then I pull you in fast enough to singe your breeches. You know any tall blondes?
I hope so. How tall?
A wop named Palermo says he saw a tall blonde come out of Phillips's building about 3:30. Says she was a looker. He gave us a good description of you, too. Didn't see her go in, just saw her come out.
Nothing comes to me. But I just remembered. I wrote down the license of Phillips' car. Might help.
Might of that.
Here.
So, just thought of this, huh?
That's right.
Well, well. Well, 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 well.
I make myself a drink, stand in the kitchen and look out of the window at the eucalyptus trees tossing their tops against the bluish dark sky. 12 hours to tie up a situation which I don't even begin to understand. Either that or turn up a client and let the cops go to work on her and her whole family. Hire Marlowe. And get your house full of law. Why worry? Why be doubtful and confused? Consult cockeyed, careless, club-footed, dissipated investigator Philip Marlowe. See me, and you meet the best cops in town.
Yeah.
Marlowe.
All right, talk it up, whoever you are.
Maybe you're a smart guy. Maybe you'd like to do yourself some good.
How much good?
About 5 C's worth.
Doing what?
Keeping your nose clean. Want to talk about it?
Where? When? Who to?
Idle Valley Club. Nash. Anytime you get here.
Who are you?
Just ask at the bar for Eddie Prue.
Oh, these gorgeous eyes. Dark and glorious eyes. Burn with passion eyes. Hypnotize. How I adore you so. How I fear you though. Since I saw you glow, now my spirit's low.
I want to talk to a fella named Eddie Prue.
Your name?
Marlowe.
Drink while you wait.
Dry martini.
Darkness yours concealed.
Okay.
Mighty fires real. They my fate will seal. Burn my soul.
We got Linda Conquest back with the band.
Well, I heard she got married to some rich guy in Pasadena.
No, it didn't take.
Nice voice, if you like female crooners.
Excuse me, do you say that singer is Linda Conquest?
Sure.
Marlowe.
Huh?
I'm Prue.
A great long gallows of a man is standing over me with a ravaged face and a haggard, frozen right eye. He's so tall, he has to stoop to put his hand on the back of my chair.
Hey, I want to talk to the girl that just sang.
Later. Mr. Nash wants to see you now.
Alex Nash has a cozy little office with French windows and a big black and chromium safe. Eddie Prue stays back by the door.
Sit down.
Thanks.
I don't like peepers.
Oh?
I don't like them for a lot of reasons. I don't like them when they bother my friends. I don't like them when they bust in on my wife. I just don't like them.
I'm beginning to get what you mean.
In my business, tough boys come a dime a dozen. And would-be tough boys come a nickel a gross. Just you mind your business, and I'll mind mine, and we won't have any trouble.
Somebody said something about money? What's that for? I know what the bawling out is for.
Talk to me like that, and you're liable to be wearing lead buttons on your vest.
Just think, poor old Marlowe with lead buttons on his vest.
Shut up, Eddie.
As for me minding my own business and not minding yours, Mr. Nash, it might be that my business and your business might get a little mixed up together.
In what way?
Your hard boy here calling me up on the phone and trying to scare me to death. And, for instance, that same hard boy or somebody who looks just like him following around after a guy who happened to get shot this afternoon.
Who got shot?
A fellow named Phillips. You wouldn't like him. He was a peeper.
I never heard of him.
And also, for instance, a tall blonde who was seen coming out of the apartment house just after he was killed.
What tall blonde?
We don't know.
Why was he killed?
We don't know.
Who is we?
The police. I found him, so I had to stick around.
What'd you tell the cops?
Very little. They didn't think it was quite the whole story. I have until tomorrow noon to fill it out.
You wasted your time coming here.
I got the idea I was invited.
You can go to hell and back anytime you want to. Or you can do a little job for me.
What's the nature of the job?
You were at my house this morning. You ought to have an idea.
Mr. Vanier?
She's a swell girl, but she's playing a wrong number at the moment.
Are you hiring me on a job or off a job I already have?
Shut up, Eddie.
You don't want your wife playing around with Mr. Vanier, is that it?
I want to find out what he's up to.
Is he up to something?
Show him the bill, Eddie.
Here. Cal Western Dental Supply Company, 30 pounds, Kerr's Cristobalite, 25 pounds, White Albastone. $15.75. HRT your paid LG Vanier.
Eddie found it in his jacket one night when he was here.
Is this supposed to mean something?
You're the detective. Here's your 5 C's. You take Vanier out of my wife's life and you get the same again.
You can give me your money when I deliver. I'll take a down payment and a short interview with Miss Linda Conquest. Or Mrs. Linda Murdoch or whatever.
Okay.
Thanks. Would you mind telling me why you had Eddie here call me up and try and give me the shakes?
Linda's an old friend of mine. Leslie Murdoch told her you were working for his mother. I didn't know what the job was. I'm just a fellow who likes his friends and doesn't want him bothered by private dicks.
Leslie Murdoch owes you some money, doesn't he?
I don't discuss things like that. I'll send Linda in to talk to you. Come on, Eddie.
So long, Marlowe.
I smoke a cigarette and look at the dental supply company's bill again. Something squirms at the back of my mind, dimly. H.R. Tiger, Dental Laboratory.
H.R. Tiger.
It clicks. Tiger is one of the names I saw on the doors of the 6th floor at the Belfont building when I did my backstairs crawl away from the dead body of Elisha Morningstar.
Tiger.
Then Linda Conquest comes in through the open door and stands looking at me with a cold light in her eyes.
By and large, I'm quite sure I'm not going to like you one damn little bit. So speak your piece and drift away.
What I like about this place is everything runs so true to type. The world-weary barman, the silent guy with a gun, the nightclub owner with the soft gray hair and the B-picture mannerisms. And now, the tall, dark torture with the negligent sneer.
What about the wisecracking snooper with last year's gags?
And what gives me the right to talk to you at all?
What does?
She wants it back, and fast, or there'll be trouble.
She wants what back, Mr. Marlowe?
The Brasher doubloon.
Oh, the Brasher doubloon.
I bet you completely forgot it.
Well, no. She wants it back, you said. Do you mean she thinks I took it?
Yeah.
Why would I take her silly old coin?
Because it's worth a lot of money. Or maybe you just took it for spite.
Maybe I ought to slap your face.
Passing on from that to perhaps more important matters, will you give Leslie Murdoch a divorce?
For $25,000, I should be glad to.
You're not still in love with the guy, huh?
You're breaking my heart.
I think he's still in love with you. After all, you did marry him.
Mister, don't think I didn't pay for that mistake. That poor port sodden fake made the bargain too tough. How do you like Leslie's mother for a client?
I've had worse.
You notice what she's doing to that girl?
Merle Davis? I noticed she bullied her.
It isn't just that. The girl had a shock of some kind, and the old brute has used the effect of it to dominate her completely. In company, she yells at her, but in private, she's apt to be stroking her hair and whispering in her ear. And the kid sort of shivers.
I didn't quite get all that.
The kid's in love with Leslie, but she doesn't know it. Something funny is going to happen in that family one of these days. I'm glad I won't be there. Mrs. Elizabeth Bright Murdoch is a smart, ruthless woman, Marlowe. Whatever she's got you doing, it's not what she says. She's up to something. Watch your step.
Would she kill?
What?
No kidding. A couple of people have been killed.
I don't get it. Murdered?
Uh-huh.
You tell Nash?
About one of them.
You tell the cops?
About one of them. So, the Brasher doubloon, you didn't take it, okay. About the divorce, what?
That's none of your goddamn business.
Agreed. Well, thanks for talking to me. Do you know a fellow named Vanier?
Yes. He's a friend of Lois. Lois Magic.
Every time his name comes up, the party freezes.
Nash will sure as hell kill him if he doesn't lay off Lois.
Lois flops at the drop of a hat. Anybody can see that.
Perhaps Nash can't. Let me tell you something else. Vanier knows Elizabeth Bright Murdoch. He never came to the house but once while I was there, but he called on the phone plenty of times. He always asked for Merle.
Merle? Why Merle?
I don't know. I'm very tired. Please go away.
All right. Good night. And thanks.
It's just as hot in Pasadena the next morning, and the big house on Dresden Avenue looks just as cool. But when they show me into Mrs. Murdoch's sun porch, she's sitting in the same chaise longue, pouring herself a slug of what looks like the same port bottle, but probably isn't.
Well,
things are bad. The cops are after me.
I thought you were more competent than that.
When I left here yesterday morning, a man followed me. I invited him to explain why, and he said he knew who I was and he needed help, and he asked me to come to his apartment and talk to him. I went, after I had seen Mr. Morningstar, and found the man shot to death on the floor of his bathroom.
Go on.
His name is George Anson Phillips. He claimed to be a private detective.
I never heard of him.
He gave me the impression he was working for some member of your family.
He wasn't. You can be quite definite on that.
I don't think you know quite as much about your family as you think you do.
You are involved with the police on account of this?
That's only half of it. How's your asthma?
Bad. Get on with your story.
I saw Morningstar. He admitted the Brasher doubloon had been offered to him and said he could get it. Then you told me it had been returned to you. I tried to get in touch with him to tell him the deal was off. I went to his office. This was quite late. He was lying on his back on the floor dead. Killed by a blow on the head. I walked away and called the hospital from the street. I didn't give my name.
That was wise of you.
It was considerate, but I don't think I'd call it wise. You take all this very calmly.
What do you want me to do?
I'm connected with one murder already. I may presently be connected with another. Even as far as it goes, I have until noon today to reveal the name of my client.
That would be a breach of confidence.
I wish you'd leave that damn port alone and make some effort to understand the position.
I beg you.
The police insist on knowing what I'm doing, who I'm working for.
You'll find a way out of all that.
To keep my job, I have to be on reasonably good terms with the police. They don't have to love me, but they have to be fairly sure that I'm not cheating on them.
Doesn't the law give you the right to protect a client? If it doesn't, what is the use of hiring a private detective?
I value your business, Mrs. Murdoch. But I'm not going to cut my throat and bleed in your lap.
You seem to have made a nice mess of the whole thing.
What's our story to the police going to be?
The police mean nothing to me. If you give them my name, I shall regard it as a thoroughly disgusting breach of faith.
Murder changes everything. You can't dummy up on a murder. As long as they think you're holding something, they'll never let up. Give them a reasonable story, and they go away cheerful. Any objection to telling it?
Every possible objection. Do we have to tell them I suspected my daughter-in-law of stealing the coin?
It'd be better.
And that it has been returned?
It would be better.
You're a callous brute. I deeply regret ever having met you.
Mutual.
Merle, ask my son to come in here at once. You may as well come in with him.
Yes, Mrs. Murdoch. He's right.
My son took the coin, Mr. Marlowe. My own son.
I told you yesterday I owe Nash a lot of money. I didn't want Mother to know. I took the doubloon and gave it to Nash, and he agreed to hold it as security. He agreed not to convert it without notice. When this man Morningstar called up, I thought Nash was thinking of selling it. I was badly scared. And then when Merle here told me Mother had employed a detective, I was sure she had missed the doubloon and hired you on that account. I went to see Nash and told him that even my mother couldn't sell the coin without violating the terms of the will. He loosened up. He gave me back the coin and tore up the receipt. So I brought the coin home and told Mother all about it.
Did Nash threaten you?
He said he wanted his money and I'd better get busy, but he wasn't threatening. He was very decent under the circumstances.
Where was this?
At his office.
Was Eddie Prue there?
Who was Eddie Prue?
Nash's bodyguard. I didn't waste all my time yesterday, Mrs. Murdoch.
I didn't see him there.
Where's the coin now?
Where would you expect it to be?
I nearly tell her, just to see her jump. But I managed to hold it in.
That seems to take care of that, then.
Kiss your mother, Leslie, and run along.
Yes, Mother.
You too, Merle. If I ever catch you violating my confidence, you know what will happen.
I never will, Mrs. Murdoch. Never. You can trust me.
I hope so. Get out. I'm very fond of my son, Mr. Marlowe. This grieves me deeply. Do you think he will have to tell this story to the police?
I hope not. He'd have a hell of a time getting them to believe it.
Just what do you mean by that?
Did he make it up himself, or did you teach it to him?
How dare you!
Nash would deny it anyway, because otherwise it would tie him to a couple of murders. It doesn't make sense.
I won't be...
But don't have a heart attack yet. You're gonna like this bit.
I found your daughter-in-law. She's back singing with the band at the Idle Valley Club. She's a pretty hard sort of girl. I don't find it impossible to think that she took the coin and that Leslie found it out and cooked up that yarn to protect her. He says he's still in love with her.
Yes, yes, poor Leslie. He would do just that.
And in that case...
In that case, my dear daughter-in-law may be involved in murder.
And you just love that.
I don't like your tone.
I don't like it myself. I don't like anything. I don't like this house, or the air of repression, or the squeezed-down face of that little girl, Merle, or your twerp of a son, or the lies I'm told.
Get out! Get out of my home!
I'd be glad to.
Mr. Marlowe? Mr. Marlowe!
What?
Please don't go away. She needs you. She really does.
Tell her to jump in the lake.
Please, Mr. Marlowe, she's in trouble. She needs you.
I'm in trouble, too. I'm up to my ear flaps in trouble.
Oh.
Hey, kid, what are you crying about? Come on.
No!
Okay. It's all right, I won't touch you, it's okay. Hey, did something happen to you when you were a little girl? A man scared you? Okay, look, I won't do anything to scare you. Not ever. If I touched you, it didn't mean anything. Is that clear?
Yes.
This man, the one who scared you, is he still around?
No, he fell out of a window.
Oh, that guy. I heard about him. Forget it, can't you?
I can't. Mrs. Murdoch is always telling me to forget it, but I just can't. I was his secretary. She was his wife. She doesn't forget it either. How could she?
But... Is there someone who has that effect on you now?
Will you promise not to tell anyone?
I promise.
Well, I'm sorry, I can't. I just can't.
All right. Hey, me again.
I thought I told you to get up.
Who's scaring the life out of that little girl?
Do you regard yourself as a clever man, Mr. Marlowe?
I'm not dripping with it.
Suppose you find out for yourself. Now go away!
I let myself out of the house. A gray Mercury comes drifting along the drive. Mr. Leslie Murdoch is driving it. When he sees me, he stops.
I guess you think I'm an awful heel.
On account of the story you told about the doubloon?
Yes.
That didn't affect my way of thinking about you in the least.
Well...
Just what do you want me to say?
I suppose I like to be liked.
I'm sorry, Murdoch. I like your being that devoted to your wife, if that's what it is.
Oh, didn't you think I was telling the truth? Did you think I was saying all that just to protect her?
There was that possibility.
I see. Well, I guess I can take it that you don't like me.
It's a silly subject and damned unimportant to both of us.
I see. Pardon me for being crude enough to bring it up.
We're all nuts, brother. Nuts. Detective Lieutenant?
You're late.
I had to go to the dentist.
I don't need to hear your story anyhow.
What?
Hench confessed to the murder of Phillips.
What? What do you use on him, a pickaxe?
Nope, he's a psycho case. Drunk but screwy drunk. He'd been living on it for weeks. He got to the point where liquor wasn't making him drunk, it was keeping him sober. When a guy gets like that and you take his liquor away, he's a lost cuckoo. So they drag him over to the hospital and shoot him full of hop. Well, this AM, he's fine. Pale, but peaceful. I go see him. How you doing, kid? Anything you need, be glad to get it for you. You know the line.
Yeah, I know the line.
So after a while, he opens his trap just enough to say, Palermo.
The guy who owns the funeral parlor.
This Palermo's important. I asked around. He gets the vote out up there. I say to Hinch, you mean Palermo's a friend of yours? He says, get Palermo. So I phone Palermo and I tell him. He's a poor guy, says Palermo. A nice guy. He wanted to see me, that's fine. I see him. I see him alone. So he goes in to see Hinch, and after a while he comes out and he says, okay, copper, he make the confess. I pay the lawyer, maybe. I like the poor guy.
Just like that?
Just like that.
You thought he was innocent.
That was last night.
That's a lovely touch. Him putting the gun under his own pillow.
Every pinch is a good pinch.
Will he cop a plea?
Sure, I think so. I figured Palermo could get him off with manslaughter.
I see.
So as it is, I don't figure I have an absolute right to insist on hearing your story.
That's very kind of you, Breeze.
Maybe later.
Maybe.
Mr. Palermo's office is exactly like a Victorian funeral parlor, with a horseshoe sofa and chairs with carved mahogany frames, and antimacassars of fine lace. Through the long curtains, across the street, I can see the windows of the apartment where George Anson Phillips was killed.
Now, what do you want, Mr. Marlowe?
I'm the man who found the dead man across the street yesterday. He was a friend of mine.
I got business. What do you want, Mr. Marlowe?
This morning, you saw Hench.
The coppers tell you that, huh?
They told me you got Hench to confess. They said he was a friend of yours.
Hench make the confess, huh?
Only Hench didn't do the killing.
No?
No.
That's interesting.
Confession is a lot of baloney. You got him to make it for some reason of your own.
Yeah, Tony!
Yeah?
Tony, there's a man, Mr. Marlowe. You look at this man, not forget him, huh?
Leave it to me, Mr. Palermo.
So, this dead guy is a friend to you, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Then I tell you, but you don't tell nobody else. Not the damn coppers, huh?
No, not the coppers.
Tony, not forget you, huh? You get the idea?
I give you my word.
Okay. I have a brother, Mr. Marlowe. Very bad. Almost as bad as Tony. This brother live across the street. Very quiet. But now, coppers, fill up the joint. Not so good. Too many questions. Not good for business. You get the idea?
Yeah, I get the idea.
Okay. This hench, poor drunk guy, got no money. I got lots of money. So I say, look, hench, make the confess. I hire a lawyer for you. Then you go to court, you say to hell with the confess. I was drunk. The judge, he turn you loose, and you come back to me, and I take care of you. Okay? So, hench, he make the confess.
And after 2 or 3 weeks, your brother is a long way from here, and the trail is cold. Is that it?
Si.
That takes care of hench, but it doesn't help me much about my friend.
It's a pity.
If I went down to headquarters and told the boys what you've told me, they'd laugh in my face.
Tony don't laugh much.
The earth's full of people who don't laugh much. You ought to know. You put a lot of them where they are.
It's my business.
I'll keep my promise. But in case you get to doubting that, don't try and make any business for yourself out of me. Because if the business got made out of Tony instead, it would be strictly on the house. No profit.
Oh, that's good. Tony, hey, one funeral on the house. Okay, hey, so long, Mr. Marlowe.
I phone the office of H.R. Teeger, and the girl tells me Mr. Teeger hasn't come in today. I get his home address, 135 Toberman Street. Nobody answers.
You want Mrs. Teeger?
Mr. or Mrs.
They gone away last night on their vacation. They loaded up and gone away late. It was kind of sudden.
Thanks.
I drive back to Hollywood. Another day drawing to its end, the air dull and tired, the traffic heavy on the boulevard, and Marlowe in his office nibbling a drink. Nobody comes in. Nothing happens. Nobody cares whether I die or go to El Paso.
Marlowe?
Mr. Marlowe, this is Mr. Shaw.
How are you, Mr. Shaw?
I'm very well, thanks, Mr. Marlowe. I hope you are the same. There's a young lady here asking to be let into your apartment. I don't know why.
Me neither, Mr. Shaw. I didn't order anything like that. Did she give a name?
Oh yes. Her name is Miss Merle Davis. She is, what shall I say, quite hysterical.
Let her in. I'll be there in 10 minutes. It's a business matter.
Oh yes, quite.
Ah, there you are, Mr. Marlowe. Miss Davis and I have been having such an interesting little conversation.
Very kind of you, Mr. Shaw.
Not at all. Well, I'll just run along now.
Thanks. I appreciate it. Oh,
not at all.
Hello there.
Hello.
You're not wearing your glasses.
No.
I got them for you.
Thanks.
While she's putting on her glasses, I slip her gun out of her bag and into my hip pocket.
So, here we are. What do we do now?
I've been to Mr. Vanier's house. He lives at the end of Escamillo Drive, at the very end.
Quite probably.
I have to take him a parcel now and then. I never liked him very well. I was afraid he would...
But he didn't.
No. But he had his pajamas on.
Lying around all afternoon with his pajamas on. Some guys have all the luck.
You have to know something. Something that makes people pay you money.
How much were you taking him today?
$500. Mrs. Murdoch said that was all she could spare. It's all my fault, and Mrs. Murdoch has always been so wonderful to me. So I did it. He was there in his pajamas. He didn't even get up to let me in. He was leering at me. I went over close to him, so I couldn't miss.
And what did Mr. Vanier do?
He didn't do anything.
Did you touch anything while you were there?
Oh, I remember one thing. I put the light out before I left. One of those lamps that shine upwards, I put that out.
How long ago?
Just before I came over here.
Where is your home?
I live with Mrs. Murdoch in Pasadena.
I mean your real home, your folks.
Oh, my parents live in Wichita, but I haven't seen them for a while.
Excuse me.
I go to the kitchen and pretend to make a drink. I look at her gun. It hasn't been fired. When I come back, she's out cold, fainted dead away on the sofa. I call Doc Moss and get him over quick. While I'm waiting, I check her bag. Tucked inside the zipper pocket is a fat pack of 10 $50 bills folded into a receipt. $500, payment on account. It doesn't seem as if it'll ever be signed now.
I'm Dr. Moss. How are you?
Aren't you the police?
Where does it hurt, Miss Davis?
Oh, nothing hurts me. Well, I don't even know why I'm lying here like this. I thought you were the police. You see, I killed a man.
Well, that's a normal human impulse. I've killed dozens. I'm just going to talk to my friend Philip in the kitchen.
All right.
What's the story?
She's secretary to a Mrs. Murdoch. About 8 years ago, a man made a hard pass at her, then fell out of a window. Since then, she can't have a man touch her.
Fell? Or jumped?
I don't know. The man was Mrs. Murdoch's first husband, Horace Bright. Merle stayed with her. Is she nuts?
It's neurosis. What's this about killing a man?
A man named Vanier. There seems to be some kind of blackmail angle. She had to take him money. She was afraid of him. She was over there this afternoon, and she says she shot him. Her gun hasn't been fired.
This is too deep for me. I'm just a doctor.
I have to go over there and see what happened. She can't stay here alone. She needs a nurse. I can sleep somewhere else.
Marlowe, the shop soiled Galahad. Okay, I'll give her a pill and find a nurse.
Thanks, Doc. The house at the end of Escamillo Drive is a narrow bungalow with a high roof. The early moon lies quietly on its small lawn. The key is in the door. There doesn't seem to be anyone in. I'm not going to work any dipsy-doodle in this place. Whatever is, is. I just want to make sure. Up by the fireplace is a brown and gold jacquard chair with a footstool. Yellow pajama legs on the footstool. Bare ankles. A dark green silk robe. A yellow neck. Vanier's face turned sideways. The shoulder dark brown with blood. The face leers all right. The right arm hangs outside the chair, the ends of the fingers touching the butt of a small revolver. A belly gun, about .32 caliber, with practically no barrel. Leaning down, I see the corner of a picture frame under the table by his chair. I reach for it with a handkerchief. A small color reproduction, not interesting at all. A guy in doublet and hose leaning out of a window. The touch of the idea at first is so light that I almost miss it. Out of a high window, a man falling to his death. A man named Horace Bright.
Mr. Vanier, you played that rather neatly.
I turn the picture over. On the back, dates and amounts of money. I work the cardboard loose. There's a white envelope between the back and the picture. In it, two photos and a negative. The photos show a man leaning out of a window with his mouth open, yelling. There's a woman's face behind his shoulder. All this takes too long. I dodge behind the curtains in the archway.
Oh, my God. He's dead.
Not bad. Try again.
He's dead. Alex, do something.
Yeah, I ought to. I ought to make you look just like him. Just as cold, just as rotten.
Oh, God.
Oh, you're not kidding anybody. You were here last night. I've been here already today. I've seen what there is to see. Oh, I can see you on the arm of the chair, rubbing his greasy hair, and then feeding him the slug while he was still purring. Oh,
don't say such awful things.
Did you wipe off the gun? Lois?
You dirty...
Did you wipe off the gun?
Yes.
And the glass you were using?
Of course.
And you put his prints on the gun?
Yes.
Pick it up. Show me how you shot it.
No.
Pick it up.
I should shoot you.
Oh, go ahead, honey.
I can't.
No, you can't. I emptied the chamber. But now, give me that. I'm going to put the bullets back, because now we've got your prints on the butt again.
You're going to turn me in?
Oh, yes, Angel, I'm going to turn you in.
Well, what's my motive?
I don't know. I don't care.
I knew he was dead. That's my key in the door. I'll talk to the Johns, but don't lay your paw on me again.
You'll go through with it, all right.
But what was my motive?
A lover's quarrel.
Maybe. When he was drunk, he looked a little bit like you. Perhaps that was the motive. Younger, with less belly, but the same self-satisfied smirk.
I'm going downtown. Now. Come on.
I come out of my hiding place, go over and pick up the gun, wipe it off. Then I reach for the trailing, bone-stiff hand. The prints won't be good, but at least they won't be Lois's. I wipe off the front door key, wipe off the thumb latch, and go on my way. Over in Santa Monica, the Hawk shop is still open. I redeem my pledge and drive on.
It's late. Mrs. Murdoch is not receiving.
Tell her it's about Miss Davis. It's important.
I'll see. You can come in.
Well?
Merle's at my apartment. She threw an ing-bing.
And just what is an ing-bing, Mr. Marlowe?
No need to worry about her. She's got a doctor and a nurse. She was over to see Vanier.
I made a mistake calling you in the first place. The loss of the doubloon would have been much easier to bear than you are.
I haven't done so badly for you, Mrs. Murdoch. You told me you got your doubloon back. I kept the police away from you so far. I found Linda, and I don't think you'll have any trouble with her.
So what's this about Merle?
You sent Merle to Vanier's place this afternoon with $500.
And if I did?
Your son told me how his father died. I looked up the records today. There was an accident in the street under his office, and a lot of people were craning out of windows. He just craned out too far.
Well?
Merle was his secretary. He made a pass at her one time and scared her out of her socks.
Yes?
She brooded, got her chance, and passed right back at him while he was leaning out of a window, murdered him, and got away with it with your help. Did Vanier have any evidence?
He talked about a photograph, but I never believed it. He couldn't have taken one.
How much have you paid him?
$11,100, not counting this afternoon.
Anybody else know?
Nobody, only Vanier.
Well, it's all over now. Vanier is through.
How?
Merle told me she shot him. She didn't. He was dead long before she got there. I phoned her father long distance. He wants her to come home. That all right with you? He doesn't know anything. I'll need that last $500 for expenses.
And how much more?
Don't say that. You know better.
Who killed Vanier?
Nash and his wife walked in on me while I was right there. He's trying to pin it on her. She probably thinks he did it. Now it shapes up like suicide.
Men like Vanier don't commit suicide.
That's like saying girls like Merle don't push people out of windows. Have Merle's clothes packed and sent to my apartment in the morning.
What?
You don't need Merle anymore. Now that Vanier is dead. One thing I wanted to ask you, this... The Bloom business is a little cloudy on account of a couple of murders which don't seem to make sense now that you have your coin back. Is there anything about the Murdoch Brasher that might identify it to an expert?
Yes. The maker's initials are on the left wing of the eagle. I'm told they're usually on the right.
You did actually get the coin back. That wasn't just something you said.
It's in the strong room this moment. If you can find my son, he will show it to you.
I'd like to speak to him. I'd like that very much.
Mother said you wanted to talk to me?
You got a gun?
Not with me.
Have it with you last night when you called on Vanier?
Oh, did I call on Vanier last night?
I think so. Your mother still thinks Linda took the doubloon, and that your story about giving it to Alex Nash is just a cover to protect
her. Leave my wife out of this.
I'm willing to, but I don't believe your story for a different reason.
What?
This... This was sent to me by a would-be detective named George Phillips.
I think he'd been hired to peddle a rare coin to a dealer named Morningstar, who suspected where the coin came from and hinted to Phillips that it was stolen. But he may be wrong about that. If your Brasher doubloon is really upstairs, then this isn't a stolen coin. It's a counterfeit.
Is this going to take long?
I'm sorry, I'll try and organize it a little better. It's not a pretty story. A man named Vanier and a man named Teager had an idea. The idea was to counterfeit a rare and valuable gold coin. The method they thought of was what a dental technician uses to make a gold inlay. You get the idea?
Yes.
But they had to have a model. That's where you come in. You took the doubloon, all right, but not to give to Nash. You took it to give to Vanier.
I don't believe
it's okay. I know he had a hold over you. I'm not just talking about gambling debts.
How did you know that?
Later. Now, Vanier and Teager wanted to know if their merchandise would stand up to inspection, so they hired a sucker to try and sell the counterfeit to Morningstar, cheap enough so the old guy would think it was stolen. They picked George Phillips. But when he showed it to Morningstar, the old man maybe thought the coin was genuine and guessed that it might be the Murdoch Brasher. So he called up here, and then your mother found the coin to be missing, and she suspected Linda and hired me to put the squeeze on Linda for a divorce.
I don't want a divorce. She had no right.
When Merle told you your mother had hired me, you came steaming up to my office, very sarcastic but very worried. You got in touch with Vanier. You had to get the coin back in a hurry. So, Vanier gave you the doubloon. Chances are it's another counterfeit. Vanier goes down to Phillips' apartment and has it out with Phillips. I believe Phillips told him he knew the job was crooked, and Vanier shot him. He searched the apartment and didn't find the doubloon. So, he went to Morningstar, cracked the old man's skull with his gun butt, and went through the safe. Then, Mr. Vanier breezes on home, still rather annoyed because he hadn't found the doubloon, but with the satisfaction of a good afternoon's work under his vest. That left you.
Why me?
You knew too much.
He was going to kill me?
Could be.
Then why didn't he?
Because you killed Vanier. You went over there last night. He sent for you. He told you he was in a jam, and if the law caught up with him, he would see you were in the jam with him. Something like that.
Yes?
Then he played his trump card. He told you the truth and said he had proof that Horace Bright's death wasn't an accident. You pulled the gun on him.
Yes. I told him to produce his proof and give it to me.
Uh-huh.
I put my gun to his head and I clicked back the hammer just to scare him. But it went off.
And you jumped back?
Yes.
You knocked the picture off the wall.
Did I? The shooting was an accident. But I think I might have gone ahead and murdered him anyway. I can't prove it.
You were lucky about the gun. All the people we know have been playing with it, wiping prints off and putting them on. I even put a set on myself just to be fashionable. Nash was over there. He thinks his wife killed Vanier, and she probably thinks he did. Well, I guess I'll just be running along now.
But aren't you going to turn me in?
You say it was an accident. I haven't any proof either way. I don't like you. I don't like your mother. I don't particularly like your wife. But I like Merle. And I know she didn't push anybody out of any window.
I don't know what to say. You're going? Just like that?
I'm going, the way I always go. With an airy smile and a quick flip of the wrist. And with a deep and heartfelt hope that I won't be seeing you in the fishbowl. Good night.
I talked to your father and mother both. They're tickled to death. They've only seen you twice in 8 years, and they feel as if they've almost lost you.
I'll love seeing them for a while. Last night...
I know. You didn't kill Vanier. That's settled. You got a shock seeing his face, and you just dramatized it in your screwy way.
Oh,
and you didn't push Horace Bright out of any window.
Dr.
Moss said I might as well hand it to you. You think you killed Horace Bright. You had a motive and an opportunity, and maybe you had an impulse. But at the last minute, probably something snapped, and you pulled a feint. He did fall, but you weren't the one that pushed him.
But...
You were made to think you pushed him. It was done with a sort of quiet ruthlessness.
Mrs. Murdoch is cold and unscrupulous, and she used you without mercy as insurance in case Vanier ever blew his top.
That's utterly impossible. You shouldn't say such awful things.
Hey, here's what I found in Vanier's apartment. Open it up.
A photo? Why, that's Mr. Bright. Not a very good picture, is it? And that's Mrs. Murdoch right behind him. Mr. Bright looks mad.
You ought to have seen him a few seconds later when he bounced.
When he what?
He's falling. He's screaming with fear. She's right behind him. Her face is hard with rage or something. Don't you get it at all?
Mrs. Murdoch has always been lovely to
me. She made you the goat. She's a smart woman. I hand it to her. I'd like to hand it to her with an elephant gun, but my polite breeding restrains me.
Well...
You don't believe a word I've said, do you?
No.
Maybe you will. Now, we're going to drive to Wichita to see your parents. But I don't think you're going back to Mrs. Murdoch.
I haven't any money.
You have $500 from Mrs. Murdoch. It's in my other pocket.
That's really awfully kind of her.
Oh, hell and fireflies. Merle's parents are kind and glad to have her back. They blame themselves a lot, and I let them do it. When I leave, Merle comes to the door and kisses me on the mouth and begins to cry, and runs back into the house, leaving the doorway empty, until her mother comes into the space with a broad, homely smile on her face to watch me drive away. I have a funny feeling as I see the house disappear, as though I had written a poem, and it was very good. And I had lost it and would never remember it again. When I get home, I call in on Lieutenant Breeze.
We cracked the Phillips case.
Uh-huh. How come?
When Vanier committed suicide.
Yeah?
It was with Hench's gun. He identified it. Then we found Vanier's prints in Hench's apartment and in Phillips's.
Motive?
Oh, sure. A guy named Teager got pinched in Salt Lake City trying to peddle fake coins. He told us he got the original of Vanier. Must have been stolen. Phillips was onto it.
I guess.
So you're in the clear.
I am?
I sometimes give a guy a break. A break he might not deserve. A little something to be paid back out of the dirty millions to a working stiff. Like me. Or you. So go home, Marlo. And be good.
I go home and set the chessmen out. And mix a drink and play over another Capablanca game. I sit at the open window and smell the night. Capablanca goes 59 moves. Beautiful, cold, remorseless chess, almost creepy in its silent implacability. I look at my reflection in the glass.
You and Capablanca. Yeah, right.
In The High Window by Raymond Chandler, adapted for radio by Robin Brooks, Philip Marlowe was played by Toby Stevens, Mrs. Elizabeth Bright Murdoch, Judy Parfitt, Merle Davis, Jessica Rain, and Leslie Murdoch by Patrick Kennedy. Linda Conquest was Susie Riddell, Detective Breeze, Joe Montana, Alex Nash, Stuart Milligan, Elijah Morningstar, Peter Policarpu, the manager, Jared McDermott, Lou Vanier, Carl Prekop, and Lois Nash was Alex Tregear. Phillips was James Laley, Mr. Shaw, Sean Baker, Hench, Alan Raglan, and John was Simon Bubb. The High Window was directed by Sasha Yevtushenko and produced by Claire Grove.
And our classic Chandler season continues next week when Marlowe finds himself drawn into the glamorous world of the Hollywood film studios. That's in The Little Sister, our Saturday play next week at 2:30. Later tonight here on Radio 4, our classic serial is an adaptation of the 1938 comic romance by Stella Gibbons of Cold Comfort Farm fame, Nightingale Wood, which begins at 9. Back to this afternoon, the news is next, and then we've a few highlights of this week's Woman's Hour. George Alagaya discussing mixed-race Britain, and we find out how to cook the perfect fish pie.